This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 95 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing philosophical themes in the Star Trek Voyager episode, Death Wish. Mike, how are you? It's been quite a while.
It has been too long. I've been trapped in a comet. I'm not sure what all that was about, but it's nice to be free, and I want to live.
You don't have a death wish?
No death wish. No death wish. I'm just glad to be out of that comet.
Well, we should say there have been lots of changes for both of us. You are officially a published author now. Your book, Hannah Goodhart and the Guardian of Time, has been released. I am teaching philosophy again at the local community college here at College of Eastern Idaho. So we both have lots of other things in our plates besides podcasting.
No doubt about it. And look at us doing what we love, right?
Isn't that the answer to any sort of suicidal death wish? Just find something you love and do it?
I think you're absolutely right.
I think Quinn from Death Wish and Voyager needed to just find a hobby or something.
Yeah, he just needed some purpose. maybe he should, you know, graduate from writing a column in the Continuum newspaper to, you know, doing a book or teaching a class. I mean, he is regarded as the greatest philosopher of the Q Continuum. I'm sure he could find a college to employ him.
I wonder if he was also the greatest podcaster in the Q Continuum.
Quite possibly could have been. maybe we should have him as a guest on Metatrex.
It's easy to forget that Voyager was in the 1990s. If it had taken place like 10 years later, Quinn would have been the greatest blogger or the greatest podcaster or the greatest social media influencer of the Q Continuum.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And since, you know, the Q exists outside of time, maybe we can have him on the show. I know he committed suicide, but you know, it's time is relative, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. What suicide would even mean to a being that is essentially outside of time?
Yes, yes. I think that should find its way into our discussion.
Indeed. I've been mentioning wanting to talk about Voyager Death Wish for quite a while now. And the genesis of this idea was that I was prepping for my intro to philosophy class that I'm teaching, and I was reading Nietzsche. And Nietzsche basically says that philosophers from Socrates onward in the Western philosophical tradition have essentially had a death wish. It's a type of escapism from Plato's forms to Descartes identifying himself as a disembodied thinking thing as opposed to his body. Philosophers have had an enormous tradition of basically denying the fact of the matter of their own existence and essentially kind of longing for either the afterlife or to transcend the physical world. And Nietzsche wrote that off as an entire like cultural death wish in philosophy. And it's interesting that Quinn has to drink the exact type of hemlock. It was I'm looking it up. What kind of hemlock was it? He had to drink Nogach hemlock at the end of the episode, an unsubtle reference to Socrates, right? So what's interesting to me about this episode is that it's often characterized as an episode about assisted suicide. You know, should we allow euthanasia, that kind of thing. But I actually think it's a much deeper a question about the meaningfulness of life and purpose. And it's more in the 20th century existential tradition of whether life is worth living in light of the potential meaninglessness of life in any grandiose, metaphysical sense. And a little less about the ethical question of suicide. As I watch it again and again, I find those kinds of existential questions about the episode way more interesting than the ethical dilemma Captain Janeway has about deciding Quinn's fate.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. In fact, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because as I've watched this episode, first time watching it, definitely the theme regarding, and let's remember, this happened in the 1990s, so physician assisted suicide was kind of a hot button topic, and I'm certain that there's some of that intended in the writing of this episode, but I look much more deeply at it now, and I see a lot more going on in terms of the meaninglessness of life. And so I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think that's really at the core of what this episode's about. And frankly, Zachary, I'm surprised. I'm shocked. I am utterly shocked that we have not discussed this episode in length before now, because I think that of all of the Voyager episodes, and you're the Voyager guy, that this perhaps is the most steeped in philosophy of any Voyager episode. There are so many subtle references. I see Nietzsche throughout this episode. I think it's heavily influenced by his philosophy. So I'm really just blown away that we haven't discussed it in depth before.
Yeah,
now
I'm thinking of all the references that feed into this episode. I see Nietzsche in it. I see Heidegger in it, insofar as Heidegger raises the question about our nature as a finite being, and how death kind of defines our existence, the meaningfulness of life mm-hmm. in light of the fact that we have a finite existence. I also see something like Camus in the Myth of Sisyphus, this endless everydayness, that the Q have, being eternal immortal beings that they don't have finitude to their existence. From the beginning of time to the end of time, the Q exist. They're essentially bored with their existence. It's a really interesting question whether all of life is like that, waking up every day, pushing your rock uphill, waking up every day, pushing your rock uphill. You get up, you go to work, you do your job, you do your hobbies, you record your podcast day in, day out, day in, day out. And there's a monotony to that. Now imagine that stretched out over an infinite lifetime of the Q, and you can start to sympathize a bit with Quinn, because that's kind of the situation we all live in, right? We have this endless monotony in our day-to-day, sort of what Heidegger called average everydayness to our existence. Now imagine that without death at the end of it, to put that at ease, or to motivate you, or to give your life some perspective, or to give your life a impetus for doing something. Like, I think the mere fact that we have a finite existence, we know we're only here for a certain amount of time, gives us some motivation to get up off of our chairs and walk out the front door and make something happen, right? Or to invest yourself in something that's meaningful. If you take away that motivating factor that your finite life has, you might very well end up, you might very well end up like the members of the Q continuum. They're in this metaphorical description of the Q continuum in their desert, sitting in their chairs, reading their newspapers, scarecrow on the, on the post.
Yeah, we've all done the scarecrow, Zachary.
Right, exactly.
Big deal.
Without death as a motivating factor to make things happen in life and to move your life forward, you might very well just throw your hands up and go, well, what's the point of doing anything? Just like the members of the Q continuum seem to have done in that representation of the Q continuum that we see in Death Wish.
Yeah, and I find that, again, I find that really at the heart of Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy. I think that's it, kind of at the core. And what's really fascinating is, as I understand it, Nietzsche was the son of a Lutheran pastor. Yes, he's the son of a Lutheran pastor. His father passed away. I think he was 4 or 5 when his dad passed away. He lost a brother not very long after that. And so there's a lot of tragedy in his life, and there's a lot of mixed signals in terms of religion giving a satisfying answer to, you know, what's going on, this loss, this pain that he's dealing with. And so I think that really shaped the man that he became. I think it shaped his spin on philosophy and his insights into the human condition. I think a lot, you know, it's interesting because I think so often Nietzsche gets a rap for being being this melancholy kind of philosopher, and so I look back and I see this pain that kind of colored his early life, and it's not surprising to me that he does have at times a pessimistic view of the human condition, there's this stoicism about his philosophy. And so I see that just woven throughout this episode, and really in a lot of ways, although we have, you know, that great reference at the end of the episode to, you know, to Socrates, I think that's just a nod to philosophy in general. I think in many ways, Quinn rather would be a great representation of Nietzsche in the continuum.
Well, in a way, both Q and Quinn, by the end of the episode, are essentially what Nietzsche would call a future philosopher, a philosopher that's able to transcend what he thinks of as this really negative part of Western philosophy, this kind of herd-like behavior that we have. You know, just a little bit of backstory on Nietzsche, but it's the part of Nietzsche that I find most interesting. Nietzsche basically thinks that we've collectively in our Western culture and in philosophy and science and psychology in particular, we've forgotten that we're embodied beings that are part of a physical world. Mm-hmm. You know, we evolved and we exist alongside other types of beasts in the world, you know, beasts with claws and fangs. And it's basically a dangerous world. We don't have these sort of brute force strength that other biological beings have. What we do have is our minds, right? And so what he thinks humans have done is basically puff ourselves up. We invented knowing as a way of making ourselves feel more secure and more safe in this fundamentally hostile world. And then we forgot that that was kind of a new development. And we philosophers in general have kind of taken this notion of consciousness or knowledge and put it up on a pedestal as being the pinnacle of consciousness, the pinnacle of evolution, the pinnacle of creation, the supreme quality compared to all these other, you know, biological beings that exist in the natural world. But along with that is this kind of herd-like behavior. You know, basically we pacify each other to get along well with each other, mm-hmm. to avoid the kind of situation that we've talked about with Thomas Hobbes before, the kind of war of all of everyone against everyone, war of all against all. So we basically learn to play well with others.
Yes.
Right? We become herd-like, both in terms of our ethical behaviors. He thinks religion and morality were basically invented for the same purposes, you mm-hmm. know, to reinforce this herd-like behavior, to make us feel a little safer and a little more secure in a hostile world. And we also invented knowing and consciousness and these lofty philosophical and scientific concepts that we you know, modern people rely on. Even the ancients in Western philosophy, Aristotle relied on this, calling us the rational animal, right?
Right.
Nietzsche basically rejects all of that. He says, look, we're fundamentally biologically situated. We have a finite lifespan. We don't have direct access to anything platonic. We have our own biological needs and drives and desires. And philosophers collectively deny all of that and look to the heavens, you know, whether it's in terms of Plato's, you know, immortality of the soul, or whether it's Descartes denying that he's, you know, equated with his body and mind-body dualism. And because of that, philosophers have an enormous death wish.
Yes.
They basically want to escape the biological facts of their own existence and all of the baggage that goes along with being a genuinely biological being. So according to Nietzsche, there will be at some point what he calls future philosophers, philosophers who are able to transcend this herd-like behavior that has plagued all of Western philosophy and Western culture. And not just philosophy, Western culture, Western science, Western knowledge, Western psychology, Western artistic movements, everything. And those future philosophers will be more artistic in nature, more individualistic, more counterculture. They will identify themselves as artistically and strongly creating their own lives, you know, in an artistic sense. You know, and you're an author, you should understand this, writing your own life as if you were the author of your own story. You don't want to write the same story as everyone else. You don't want to, you know, write the same book that, you know, Joe author down the street is writing. You want to write something different. So being purposefully different and unique and having your own perspectives and defining your own purposes, going purposely against the herd, is a part of what Nietzsche thinks it takes to overcome this Western mindset. Not even a return to an ancient mindset. It really is like recognizing that we all have our own metaphors and our perspectives and our own needs and our own situatedness. And because of those things, we write our own story. And to objectify things, to rely on objective knowledge, or to rely on this, again, I keep calling it this, but I think this is what Nietzsche really thinks, this philosophical death wish that Western philosophy has had, is basically to be weak and herd-like and reactive rather than embracing the kind of being we really are, which is a biological being with our own unique subjective perspective on things. And future philosophers will embrace that subjectivity and their individual uniqueness in a way that he thinks all of Western philosophy has de-emphasized and in fact tried to escape from. So I think this little conversation that happened at the very end of the episode, when Janeway tells Q, "I imagine that the continuum won't be very happy with you, Q," and Q says, "I certainly hope not," I think that is a prototypical example of a Nietzschean future philosopher. Like, I don't want to be like the rest of the Q continuum. I'm going to be Q. And that, if anything, is an example of Nietzsche's Übermensch. I think that completely is. It's not Übermensch in the sense that the Nazis used it. It's not Übersense in the sense of like Aryan purity or anything like that. It's an Übermensch in the sense of being your own strong individual, purposefully different from the herd-like behavior of everyone around you. So again, I don't think euthanasia is actually the point of this episode.
Yeah, I don't either. And but you know, I think it's interesting because John Delancey's Q, let's distinguish them. So we have Quinn and we have Q, John Delancey's Q. By the way, I just want to say that Garrett Graham has been criticized for his portrayal of Quinn in this episode. I've heard fans say that he's a little creepy or a little weak or a little weird, and I disagree completely. I think Garrett portrayed this character brilliantly. What a contrast to the Tosk Hunter of Deep Space Nine. So you know, hats off to Garrett Graham for his portrayal of Quinn. But it's interesting because when Q shows up, his finger is pointing at Quinn, saying, you know, he's insane. That's his claim. You know, he's nuts because he doesn't think like the rest of us. Because after all, when we first find Q at the beginning of this episode, he's a born again Q. He's rank and file Q.
He's a born again Q.
that's what he says. He says, I've been born again. I'm a born again Q. So he's this rank and file Q, who by the end of the episode is back to the Q we recognize from TNG. He's, you know, he's inspired. He's you know, ready to transcend the Q, ready to kick up some dust once again and make John Luke's and Janeway's life, you know, just living chaos. And so, but when we find him at the beginning of the episode, he's saying that Quinn is crazy. That's his claim, because he doesn't think like the rest of the Q. He doesn't want to do the things the other Q want to do. He's obviously crazy. And again, I think this is pointing directly at Nietzsche, because at the end of Nietzsche's life, he famously, you know, wrote the Wahnzettel, the madness letters. And you know, he had mental health issues at the end of his life and went insane. And so I don't think that it's by mistake or a happy accident that the accusation is that Quinn has gone insane.
But to give Nietzsche a little more credit than that, Nietzsche was a philologist, and you know, looking back at the history of Western culture and Western thought, he looked back at ancient cultures and said, ancient cultures prioritized individualism. You know, they liked the Julius Caesars and the Alexander the Greats, and it was very much in a conqueror sense, right? And maybe not in the cultural sense that he's trying to get at. But the idea that you should be a strong individual as opposed to a weak herd-like member of society mm-hmm. is something he finds in ancient cultures. Now, okay, so that happens. Then we get Western philosophy and Western culture that basically start with Socrates, he thinks. You know, from there we get, he thinks of as a pacification of all of our mindsets, all of our ethics, all of our religion, all of our beliefs about knowledge, all of our beliefs about how to function with each other in a society. In fact, I just did HR training at the community college I teach at, and most of it was things like, here's how you play nicely with a herd. You dress nicely, and here's how you type an email, and here's how you do this, and here's how you do that. And it's all very passive. Like, you know, here's how you play nice with others. Nietzsche looks back at the history of Western thought and says, okay, so that happens and Western culture starts to take this kind of reactive passivity, herd-like behavior. But there are these rare individuals that come along seemingly out of nowhere that go against the grain. There are philosophers that reframe philosophical discussions. There are scientists like Einstein. And this is after Nietzsche, of course, but this is a great Nietzschean example. There are philosophers like Einstein who reframe all of scientific knowledge in a new way. They're not just working on their own little problem, taking things for granted. They're an emergent figure who reframes the entire discussion. There are artists. There are musicians. There are the Beatles of the world who change music forever, right? These figures seemingly come out of nowhere. And one of two things happens to them. They're so different that they're put on a pedestal as a genius, or they're called a madman because they go against the grain too much. and that's what's, yeah, and Nietzsche says as much. If you basically go against the herd, you're either a genius or you're a madman in cultural eyes. You know, we either put you on a pedestal or we put you in a prison. You know, put a straitjacket on you. And that's essentially what's going on with Quinn, right? He's too much of an individual for this herd-like Q continuum. So yeah, they put him in a prison. This is exactly the point that Nietzsche's making about rare individuals.
Yeah, and I referenced a moment ago the madness letters, these letters that Nietzsche sent out near the end of his life. And on the surface, they all appear to be full of meaningless gibberish. And so we point to that and we say, okay, there's evidence that, you know, Nietzsche has gone mad. And so I think it's interesting that Quinn pulls a magazine article, My Corner of the Continuum. This is his own madness letter. And it's interesting because if you zoom in on that, you can actually read some of the text.
Oh, I've never done that. What does it say?
So he says, I'm ready to die. How about you? Okay. And then he goes on to say, for many years, I have put my thoughts to paper and written this column. It has occurred to me that I would run out of things to say, find nothing new to comment about, but I have. And it's deeply troubling to me. Frankly, I believe the time has come for the continuum to look at the possibility that immortality is not in this society's best interest. End quote. I'm just going to end it right there. You can read more. But so there's the statement that he makes, I think, that has just upset the apple cart for the Q continuum, and it has sent this society into turmoil and has raised questions about Quinn's mental health because he questions whether or not immortality is in the society's best interest.
I think where this episode for me fails a little bit is that there are so many separate issues that are being conflated in the same drama. We've got, and maybe that's what makes it brilliant. Maybe that's where it fails dramatically.
I think it's where it's brilliant.
One of the issues is, of course, the issue of euthanasia and suicide. You know, the other is this issue of the meaningfulness of life. But there's also this kind of individualism versus collectivism, or the individual versus the state issue. It almost has this kind of democracy versus you know, socialism kind of tone to it in some of the discussions that Janeway and Q have. For me, I find it a little hard to separate those issues, and I don't actually find all of them as interesting. Like the individual versus the state, I actually kind of go, okay, this is such a vastly oversimplification of that kind of discussion that I don't actually find that part of the philosophy of this episode very interesting compared to the meaningfulness of life questions. Again, is that a good thing about this episode? Is that part of what makes it philosophically brilliant, or is it kind of just a sloppy conflation of these separate issues?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant because there's so much presented there, and there's so much for us to kind of focus in on and discuss. Certainly the euthanasia, again, I think that given the fact that this was, this was the 1990s, and that was kind of a hot button issue.
More relevant then than now.
Yeah, certainly more relevant mm-hmm. then. And for me, honestly, that's kind of the sadness of the episode. Janeway challenges Quinn. Hey, now that you've got, your mortality, I challenge you to find within it this grand adventure. She says, "I love this life," and so she's experiencing the adventure of her mortality, and she's challenging Quinn to do the same thing. But then a few moments later, she's having a conversation with Tuvok, and they're trying to find something meaningful for Quinn to do there on Voyager. And even then they have to come to the conclusion that while he has plenty to offer them, there's really nothing new for him to experience. There's nothing new for him to learn or to discover. He brings a lot to the table for Voyager, but Voyager doesn't have much to offer him. But, and at the end of the episode, certainly Q makes sure that he has the hemlock and he gets his death wish given to him. And that, to me, is very sad because I look at it in terms of he did have a lot to offer, but I also have to step back and recognize that Voyager didn't have much to offer him other than, just the opportunity to exist.
Well, this is a good segue into the next topic I wanted to talk about. There's really two big topics I wanted to talk about from here. I want to talk about the meaningfulness of life and maybe by an extension, whether an immortal life would be worth living or not. And then again, maybe by extension, is our human life worth living, right? There's an absurdity and an everydayness and a boredom to our own daily existences that really makes you go, well, is this life even worth living, immortal or not? So that's one topic, the question of meaningfulness, as it relates to suicide and, the things we have to get through in our day-to-day lives and our given the kind of beings we are. And the other I want to talk about is the nature of the Q continuum as it's depicted inside this episode, because I think this is also a very Nietzschean way of thinking about how to represent concepts. So I want to talk about that. But let's talk about the question of meaningfulness first. So my two questions are fundamentally, would an immortal life be worth living? If you can experience everything, and in Quinn's case, if he has experienced everything there is to experience, if you're outside time, and again, we've talked about this before on Metatrex, but it's not totally clear how the Q experience time. Sometimes they seem to experience it linearly along with humans. Sometimes they seem to experience it as a whole, like they're outside space-time, this God's eye point of view on time. Mm-hmm. So it's not totally clear.
Right.
The Star Trek kind of waffles on how the Q relate to time in that way. But okay, so assuming the Q are immortal and Quinn has experienced it all, would that kind of life still be worth living? The second question in that category of questions is, well, what about us, our human life? If you take away, in this Nietzschean sense, if you take away anything objective, objective meaning, objective purpose, this escapism, trying to escape our situated biological existence, if we look towards heaven or look towards the afterlife or we look towards, Plato's forms or however it's been spelled out in philosophy and religion and science, anything that escapes our presentness, and our biology, just anything that kind of denies the kind of being that we are, which are the situated biological beings for Nietzsche. If that's the case, if there's no grand meaning with a capital M or purpose with a capital P or truth with a capital T, what is the meaningfulness of our lives? And is that life arbitrary and worth living? I recently reread Camus, his essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, and And he asked this fundamental question. In fact, it's one of the most memorable ways of starting a philosophical work that I've ever read. He says, there's only one truly philosophical question, and that is the question of suicide, whether life is or is not worth living. All the other philosophical questions come after that. The question for us is life worth living? And he immediately transitions to looking at Sisyphus. And if you remember, Sisyphus is it's a myth, right? Mm-hmm. He was punished by the gods, condemned to push a giant stone, a boulder, up a mountain, only to have it fall back down the mountain. He has to go back down the mountain the next day or the next hour, who knows how long it takes, and push that rock up the mountain again. And he gets to the top and the rock falls down. And he has to push it back up and the rock falls down. And condemned to that existence for all of eternity. No end in sight. The kind of immortal existence that the Q are maybe condemned to in Quinn's eyes. It's an interesting analogy for our lives. You know, we're at least bound by time. We're not condemned to this life for all eternity, right? But even assuming we were, you know, if it's basically one stone after another, and I think from the perspective of immortality, you could look at anything you might care about, any project you take upon yourself, any work you do, anything you construct, anything you might learn, any new, whether it's relationships or family or projects or things you learn or whatever, they're all going to take on this Sisyphus-like mm-hmm. quality in the long run. You've been there. You've done that. You've accomplished it. You got the rock to the top of the mountain. So what? You got to start all over the next day and do something mm-hmm. else. And even the variety of things you might do if you had an infinite amount of time start to take on this mundane Sisyphus-like quality to them in the fact that they just never end. You know, it's just one challenge after another. Even the novelty kind of loses its luster in that perspective. That's basically what Quinn's saying. That, you know, existence has basically lost its luster. Anything you might accomplish is meaningless and absurd when viewed from this perspective of immortality. And it's really interesting to talk, and I want to hear your perspective on this, because you identify as a Christian believer. Mm-hmm. You believe in an afterlife that's mm-hmm. eternal. What is satisfying about that existence in light of these insights from Quinn or from Camus about the nature of an immortal existence?
I'm glad you asked that, because I do look at this question through the prism of my faith, and I find my meaning and my purpose and my sense of value in those tenets of my faith. The fact that God's Son came and gave his life to pay the penalty for you know, my sin, I've blown it in this life. You know, the Bible says that all have sinned and we've come short of the glory of God. We've all blown it in life, and that sin has separated us from a holy God. And so the Son of God comes and gives his life to pay the penalty for my sin. So that gives me a sense of intrinsic value, that God would see me as something valuable enough to give his own life to redeem. So that gives me a sense of worth. I have self-worth, not because I'm something special, but because he is. He is something special, and he gave himself for me. However, you know, I what I find interesting in this episode of Voyager is that the early argument that Q makes for Quinn's value is the impact that he's had on the life of, and he uses three individuals that he brings mm-hmm. to testify to Quinn's worth because of the impact he's had on their life. And I think more than any other Star Trek episode in which Q is the centerpiece, this episode, I think, inserts the Q continuum in the role of God probably more than any other. This is a direct effect of the Q continuum on the course of human history. For Isaac Newton, it was Q who shook the tree. So, or Quinn who shook the tree, and the apple falls, and it changes the course of science forever. And you know, for Riker, it was the impact that he had on his ancestors that ultimately led to his being born, and the impact that he's had in, you know, here in the 23rd century. So or 24th century. So I think it's interesting. I think it's fascinating that more than any other episode of Star Trek, we're really kind of inserting the Q continuum into the role of God. So that raises the question that is our sense of value or worth merely tied to the impact that we have on the world that we're in? And certainly I find value in what I can contribute, my small part that I can do to try to make this world a better place. And I get some fulfillment and I get some meaning. I get some value out of that. But even in the days when I don't feel like I've done anything worthwhile, and we all struggle with that, right? We all have that struggle in life. You know, am I doing anything that matters? I think we all ask that question at some point in our lives. You know, it's in those moments that I fall back on the fact that even when I don't see value in myself, you know, God sees value in me, so much so that to use the metaphor that Jesus uses in the gospel, I'm the pearl of great price that the master swept the house to find.
Well, I think this is a fundamental question about the nature of meaningfulness as it relates to this discussion. Do you find meaningfulness in terms of the purpose of life and the meaningfulness of life in some sort of objectivity or some sort of afterlife, right? If you're always looking to the afterlife, if you say, okay, if you're like a Christian believer, you might go, okay, I find meaningfulness in the afterlife, all the intrinsic mm-hmm. meaningfulness that you just described. If you are a philosopher like Plato looking to Platonic forms, the meaningfulness of your life and your purpose, like for Socrates, was to kind of aim towards that, right? That's the meaningfulness of life. Another way of looking at the meaningfulness of life is that meaningfulness happens here in the world, right? You know, the other type of meaning you just described, what, yes. You know, helping others, you know, doing good things in the world, whatever it is, that's a meaningful activity. So it's a really interesting question. Like, what is the sphere of meaningfulness? Does meaningfulness require this kind of objective, immortal, you know, Q-like perspective on things, you know, the God's eye point of view on meaningfulness? Or does meaningfulness happen at the micro level here in the real world? You know, can there still be meaningfulness if that first kind of meaning doesn't work out? And this is the Nietzschean insight, that there is no such thing as that other kind of meaningfulness. That's a kind of escapism, or that's a kind of denial of the kind of beings we are. A lot of people just don't believe in that kind of meaningfulness. You know, we know we're not immortal beings, you know, that kind of thing. So, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, and that's interesting that you say that you said we are not immortal beings. That the reality is, the Christian philosophy teaches that we are immortal beings. There is an immortality to being human. That there is something beyond this flesh and blood life. And so the reality of eternity, at least in terms of Christian philosophy, is a fact. And frankly, I've meditated often on that truth. And, you know, the idea of sitting on a cloud playing my harp for, you know, millions and millions of years is not very satisfying for me.
No, it's funny. Like, imagine, like, okay, you're 20,000 years into the afterlife, and you're like, okay, God, not another... Lightning is going to strike me down here, by the way. not another meeting with those angels.
Yeah.
So tedious.
Yeah.
You know, the system is pushing the rock up the hill again, right? But I think, you know, those questions I think are not likely to be answered. And I think not from a philosophical standpoint anyway. And I think this is Nietzsche's point that any philosophers have said, I've got the answer to the question of meaningfulness, and it's Plato's forms, or it's Descartes, right. I think therefore I am, or it's, you know, it's some sort of objective morality, or it's religious belief, whatever it is. Nietzsche says, no, all of that is like escapism, denying the kind of being we really are. So if there's meaningfulness, it's got to be meaningfulness here for us in the physical world in a smaller degree. And then it's like, okay, if we know we have a finite existence, Heidegger says a lot about this. Heidegger basically says we're finite beings, and that motivates us to care about things. We invest ourselves in projects. We're constantly sort of throwing ourselves into the future, imagining different possibilities for ourselves. And if we're authentic, we do that in a way where we do it in terms of things we care about. We invest ourselves in projects and relationships and things that give our lives meaning in some authentic sense. Camus, by contrast, kind of says, well, no, there's this like mundane quality to all of it, right? It's basically Sisyphus pushing that rock uphill day in, day out. It could be, you know, the daily things you have to do. You wake up, you make the coffee, you brush your teeth, you get ready for work. You do that day in, day out. whether it's relationships, whether it's projects, whether it's podcasts, whether it's anything that you might do on the Enterprise, you know, all of that is going to have this mundane-like quality to it. No matter how important it is, the next day you have to get up and do it all over again. You know, no matter what you've accomplished, you still have what's going to happen tomorrow. And it's got this kind of, I don't know how to put it, like a Death of the Salesman kind of quality to it, mm-hmm. right? Willy Loman in Death of a Salesman. He really wants to be a salesman, but he's terrible at it. It alienates him from his family. He doesn't feel very authentic when he's doing it. He's actually not very good at it. And he dies at the end of the play. And that's a very mm-hmm. 20th century existential play. And he dies at the end. And that's the end of the play. It's like the myth of Sisyphus without the immortality. You know, it's like this is just, you know, what Heidegger called the average everydayness of our existence, right? Mm-hmm. Is there enough meaningfulness in the sort of physical, concrete, biological world we're in to overcome the existential dread of being like Sisyphus? Is that meaningful enough? Or do we keep looking to the heavens? Or do we keep looking to the stars in Star Trek? You know, and Star Trek is just as guilty of this, right? Star Trek looks to the cosmos. You know, it's not enough to sit on your planet and have meaning. You got to get out there in the cosmos. And that's going to be the savior of mankind. You know, you could look at Star Trek and say that's the same kind of escapism, right? but again, I think for me, the fundamental question is, if it turns out that there is no objective meaning, if there's not an afterlife, if that doesn't have the intrinsic meaning that you described, if we're not the kind of immortal beings that philosophers and theologians have thought we are, if it turns out that we don't find the answers to our purposefulness out there in the cosmos 1,000 years from now when we're out there riding the stars on the Discovery, right? If it turns out that none of that holds true and we just have this earthly existence with our little projects and that's all we've got, is that enough to overcome this deep worry that life is meaningless and maybe suicide worthy, that it's maybe fundamentally isn't worth living when looked at from this God's eye point of view?
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, from the perspective of Christianity, our value isn't in the daily grind of living life. Our value is found by looking at our lives through that God's eye view, through God's perspective. If I am worth redeeming, then that is where my value lies. And so that, you know, Quinn doesn't really have that. You know, Quinn essentially in this episode is God. So then we have to kind of ask the question, what if God decides that he doesn't want to exist? What does that mean? What does that mean for us? What does that mean for the universe?
Well, in a way, theologically, that doesn't make sense, right? If you kind of take this perfect being theology that you get from medieval philosophy into the modern period, you might say that just doesn't make sense. If you think of God as a necessarily existing being, then God just can't choose not to exist, right? If he necessarily exists, he can't not exist, and that's the end of the story. And you could make the same point about Q. If Q is a necessarily existing being that transcends time, as opposed to all the finite, non-necessary beings here in space-time, in what way can a necessarily existing being will itself into non-existence? Like, that just, there's something fundamentally illogical about that. So that might be another worry about this episode, that the fundamental premise that a Q can commit suicide is deeply flawed if the Q are analogous to perfect being theology in Judeo-Christian theology.
Sure. But that is part of the problem in the episode. Q in his omnipotent form cannot commit suicide. He has to be reduced to a mortal form, and in that mortal form, then he can die. And by the way, that's another one of those real neat, I think, kind of Nietzschean nods in this episode, is the fact that, you know, Nietzsche famously said, "God is dead, for we have killed him." Right?
I didn't even think about that obvious connection.
Yeah. So I think it's just one of those kind of Nietzschean nods in the episode. We're dealing with the death of God, and at the episode, God essentially dies. And so what does that mean? What does that mean for the continuum? What does that mean for Voyager? One of the things that I really appreciate about this episode is it does raise so many really interesting questions. Again, I'm not put off with, you know, this idea that, you know, there may be too much packed in and, you know, you might have some conflating of ideas, and I'm not put off by that. It's just so packed, so jam-packed that it raises all kinds of really interesting questions.
Getting back to Camus and the myth of Sisyphus, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, Camus basically says, we can't help but imagine Sisyphus happy. He gets, you know, every day he gets up and he's got a project to do. He pushes that stone up the mountain. And maybe he's a little stone-faced, you know, pardon the pun, as he has to, you know, go back down the mountain every day. But he lives his life in terms of blissful ignorance, right? He accepts his fate, the fact that he has to do this day in, day out, and every day he can put a smile on and push that rock up the mountain. And basically says, that's how we are. You know, we get up and we put a smile on. We accept the fact that, you know, there's an absurdity to human life. There's a lack of meaningfulness in a capital M, with a capital M, to all of our projects and all the things we care about. But nonetheless, we do care about them, and we put a smile on, and they make us happy. You know, I've got my hobbies. I do podcasts and ham radio, and Haley's got her hobbies. She cross stitches and lots of things, right? And all of those things are in a way meaningless. They're not looking to the heavens. They're not looking to the stars. They're not looking to the afterlife, right? They're meaningful for me here, right now, in the moment, right? And if I start to dwell on them too much, I can go, oh my God, I just spent an hour on my ham radio. Oh my God, how meaningless is that? I better commit suicide now. Right? But that's not how caring about something works. You care about something in the moment, right? And that's basically what Camus and Heidegger, to some extent, and definitely Nietzsche, are saying, that the things we care about and the things that make us who we are, the things that define us, are not given their meaningfulness by taking this afterlife perspective or taking this God's eye perspective or taking the perspective of objectivity. They're meaningful to me right here, right now, because I'm the one who decides what I care about. And that's the end of the story. So if you take that perspective on Sisyphus, you might go, yeah, I could imagine Sisyphus being happy, pushing that rock up the mountain every day. I can imagine Captain Janeway being happy every day, you know, going and getting her cup of coffee black from Neelix every day, not from Nietzsche every day. That'd be hilarious.
Yes.
I can imagine anything that any of us cares about giving enough meaning to make you want to get up and do it all again the next day, even if the afterlife weren't true, even if there's no objective meaning, even if there's no objective truth to the matter. It's still important for me right now, and that's enough to cause me to put a smile on and do it all over again the next day. And that's essentially the kind of dissatisfying answer that Camus gives to the situation, that, yeah, you can make yourself content with the absurdity of life by investing yourself in something you care about. Heidegger says as much. Camus says as much. Yeah. Nietzsche is a little more forceful about it, basically saying, oh, no, you can be radically different than everyone else. You know, you don't want to be heard like. You don't want to be weak and like everyone else. You want to be a strong individual and write your own meaning in some artistic sense. Take your own perspectives and take your own metaphors and define your own purpose. Be an Übermensch. He's way more forceful about it than the others. But again, there's something satisfying about that, because it does answer the question of meaningfulness. Yeah, we can find meaningfulness in the day-to-day of our existence, whether that existence is finite or infinite in the case of the Q. But there's also something dissatisfying about it, because it's not an answer that relies on objectivity. It's not an answer that relies on God. It's not an answer that relies on you know, universal truths, objective purposes. It reduces the concept of meaning that philosophers and theologians have put up on a pedestal in terms of its objectivity, and taken it down to the earthly sphere. Like, no, meaningfulness resides right here in my life today, and that's the meaningfulness of life. End of the story. Yeah. And there's something also just dissatisfying about that, because all these things that have defined Western culture and Western religion kind of go out the window in that perspective. What does that mean for the meaningfulness of life? You know, can you imagine Quinn being happy? And maybe this is a problem in the Q continuum. Maybe collectively in the Q continuum, they all just needed to like get a new hobby. Maybe that's the answer. Like, okay, you know, somebody beam them a ham radio, or beam them a coloring book, or beam them a cross stitch pattern. Like, they need something to do in the Q continuum.
We'll get to the nature of the Q continuum in a minute. I think we should talk about that a little bit.
Oh, definitely. But I think is that a possibility? Like, the fact that Quinn is saying, look, we've been there and we've done it all. There is nothing left that's new to do. We've done every hobby, every interest, everything there is to learn, every way of being, scarecrow or otherwise. They've done it. So if you take away the possibility of novelty, that might change the map a little bit. Like,
yeah,
for here for us in the physical world, we only have so much time. Heidegger says this really clearly, and that defines the meaningfulness for us. Every day you have to choose what to do. What are you going to care about? What are you going to invest yourself in? What are you going to spend time doing? What's authentic for you? And there's lots of novelty out there. There's always mm-hmm. a new hobby, always a new job, always a new career, always a new degree yeah. to get, always something new to learn, always another planet to explore if we're in the Federation, right? There's a ton of novelty. What Quinn is saying, though, is that there really is no more novelty for the Q continuum. Like, you can't even find that kind of meaningfulness, because they've been there and done it all. The possibility of novelty is gone for them.
Yeah. The thing I find interesting is that life can sometimes be subjective, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. It's fascinating to me because the ancient King Solomon, famous King Solomon, reportedly the wisest man who ever lived, famously says, you know, vanity, vanity, it's all vanity. There's nothing new under the sun. So he has this kind of existential crisis, it seems, later in life. And he questions the nature of his own existence and whether or not there's anything left to do that's original or unique in the world. And he comes to this conclusion that, you know, life is, you know, just, it's vain. And so he begins to explore his value through the lens of his relationship with Jehovah God. But my faith aside, Zachary, I came to a point in my own life, I kind of had a Dantean crisis. I woke up one day and I realized that I probably had more years behind me than I had ahead of me. And I began to wonder if I was missing out on some great fulfillment in my life. I had dreams. You know, when I was a child, I had dreams, and you know, was I doing enough to chase those dreams? And I think everyone on the other end of this podcast is holding on to a dream. Everyone has had a dream in their life, and so, you know, what have we done to chase those dreams? But I said that life is subjective. So for me, I needed to change things up in my life. I came to a point in my life where I had a dream. I wanted to be a published author. So, you know what? If I'm going to make that happen, I need to, you know, put my butt in a seat, and I need to start typing. And, you know, out of that comes Hannah Goodhart and the Guardian of Time. You know, for you, it might be something different. It, you know, maybe it was the podcast. Maybe it's, you know, your fulfillment is in ham radio. It's the hobbies that you do. But for some people, it's not about doing something new. It's the fulfillment they find in that routine. Not everyone is Sisyphus, resigned to his situation. But the reality is that the world is full of people who like and are fulfilled in that sense of mundane routine.
To press the Sisyphus view a little bit more, I see what you're saying. You know, we all have things we care about, things we want to accomplish, dreams we have, whatnot. Suppose all of those were like instantly fulfilled. You became an author, you know, whatever your dreams are, boom, mm-hmm. They're fulfilled. You do it with a smile, even like Camus says, you can imagine Sisyphus with a smile pushing his rock up the hill every day, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, no matter what you accomplish, no matter what dreams get fulfilled, doesn't it have this kind of mundane quality to it? Like you accomplished the thing, and now you have to do it all over again the next day. it's like a Pyrrhic victory, you know. This is like Camus talking now, right? You know, it still has this. It's not as existentially fulfilling as we want it to be, right? Mm-hmm. You're a published author now. You met the goal. You had a dream fulfilled, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing right now? Writing the next one.
Writing the next one.
It's push that rock up the hill again, right? No matter what you accomplish, there's always a sense of like, that's not enough. And it's not in the sense of like, that's not enough. Give me more. It's not enough in the sense of the story doesn't end there, right? Life goes on and there's the next challenge you're going to face tomorrow. Could be the same kind of challenge writing the next novel. Could be a different challenge, a different project, a different thing you care about. But again, that's not meaningfulness with a capital M, right? This is like, yes, I might care about it in the moment, and I care about my dreams, but it doesn't solve the mundaneness of those things, right? Any one of those accomplishments, any one of those dream fulfillments is still as satisfying as Sisyphus getting his rock to the top of a hill.
Sure. And to counter that, you know, let's talk a little bit about the fulfillment of contributing to society in some way, shape, or form. You know, I like to think that this podcast contributes to the entertainment of those individuals that choose to download and listen to it.
And philosophical edification.
Absolutely. I like to think that connecting with people through your hobby of ham radio is somehow fulfilling not only to you, but to the individuals that you connect with in all parts of the world. For me, it's getting to meet people. I've really enjoyed. We've done some events where we've gone to book festivals and we've done some bookstores, and I've gotten to do some school visits where I get to talk to kids and I get to connect with them through literature. That to me is fulfilling for me, but I like to think that it's also fulfilling for the kid. And I can remember being on the other end of that. I can remember sitting in a classroom on a conference call. Back then, we didn't have video chats. We did conference calls with telephone landlines. On a conference call.
Simpler times.
You know, with a songwriter talking about, you know, crafting lyrics for a song and finding meaning in song lyrics. So I know that that was inspiring to me as a child. So I like to think that, you know, I'm doing something to help edify and inspire young people. And that can apply to virtually anything.
Oh, I'm an educator. I completely understand.
Absolutely.
That's most of the meaningfulness of being an educator, is inspiring something in your students. They're going to go out and, you know, do great things in the world and, you know, take whatever perspectives you're trying to help them cultivate. And
absolutely.
Yeah, you
inspire them. For the chemist, it might be, you know, finding a cure for a disease or a treatment for something. For, you know, and you can go on and on. We can sit here all day and give examples of you know, how what we do kind of contributes to society. And in TNG, they kind of have this conversation about how they work in the 21st century, not for wages, but for the opportunity to benefit society, to make life better.
Or themselves, some sort of intrinsic meaning in improving themselves. Yeah, the human journey.
Yeah. It's not meaningfulness with a capital N.
Right.
You're absolutely correct.
Yes, and I guess that's fundamentally my point, that we're still in a very kind of existential interpretation of meaningfulness here. I also recently reread Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, which we've talked about on the podcast before, but it's interesting to read it in light of everything we just said, and especially teaching Intro to Philosophy again, and you know, making connections between things that I hadn't thought about in some time. And this is a perfect example. You know, Marcus Aurelius talks about the transiency of things, the ephemerality, the fact that the finitude of things, no matter what, and he was a Roman emperor. If anyone's going to be remembered, it's a Roman emperor, right?
Sure.
No matter what monument you build, no matter what you accomplish, no matter what empire you forge, in the long term, even those things decay, right? The pyramids are still standing for now, but give it another 1 million years or 5 million years or 20 million years or 1 billion years, right? Give it 10 billion years when our star isn't around anymore. You know, no matter what meaningfulness you try to find, and you and I are both into genealogy and ancestry,
sure.
You know, we find that interesting. We share that interest in common. You know, it's nice to think about, okay, leaving some sort of a legacy behind. You know, I kind of inherit the legacy of everyone who came before me, whether biologically or culturally or in terms of ancestry, whatever it is, right? Culturally too, we're the cultural inheritors of everyone who came before us. It doesn't even have to be genealogy per se, cultural genealogy. And it's interesting, some philosophers like Nietzsche and Foucault, for example, have emphasized this sort of cultural genealogical way of thinking about culture. But even those decay, you know, no matter what family tree you leave behind, in the long run, even that's going to come to an end. And no matter what monument you build, even that's going to come to an end. No matter what legacy you leave for future humans, no matter what good you do in the world, all of that will come to an end someday. You know, the monuments will crumble and the people will die. humans will die out. Even put it on a cosmic Star Trek scale. Suppose our star dies and we're out there exploring the galaxy. Future humans, whatever we evolve into in 1 million years, suppose they're out there amongst the stars. You know, maybe they're not even like us anymore biologically. Maybe they've evolved so much that we wouldn't even recognize them. But even that's going to come to an end. The universe is either going to come to a big crunch or it's going to have a heat death and fizzle out, right?
Yes.
No matter what your answer is, it's eventually going to come to an end, you know, unless it's like a disembodied afterlife, right? If it's Plato's, you know, immortal soul, or if it's a, you know, the Christian notion of heaven, or if it's something else, right? That's a different situation. But if we're not talking about that, whatever answer you have to the question of what legacy you leave behind, what difference you make in the world, is eventually going to come to an end. And
sure,
this is as a kind of the Stoic standpoint. Like, imagine, you know, all your friends dead. Now imagine, you know, all of humanity wiped out in the future. Imagine all of your projects that you care about crumbled to ashes, right? This is human existence from the Stoic standpoint. So get used to it. In other words, given all of that, is there enough meaningfulness in the day to day you know, the difference you think you're making in the world, the projects that you care about, the inspiration right. that you give to those kids when you give, you know, when I'm teaching college or when you're talking to kids about writing, you know, right. is that enough meaningfulness to overcome the meaninglessness on the grand scale when all of those mm-hmm. projects come to an end and all the people involved are going to be dead?
Right. Yeah. From dust thou art and unto dust thou shalt return. Kansas famously said, dust in the wind. Everything
dust
is
in the wind.
Dust yeah. in the wind. It's or in this case, dust on the continuum road.
That was not Socrates. Know. That was not Socrates. That was Marcus Aurelius. Get it right. Someone needed to proofread their script.
Yeah, without a doubt. But in this case, it's dust on the continuum road, evidently. And so we've talked here for a while. I think we should probably transition a little bit to how Death Wish, this season two episode of Star Trek Voyager, depicts eternity, the Q continuum.
I mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast, and I really believe it. This is another aspect of the episode that I can trace directly to Nietzsche. And maybe it's just because I read Nietzsche and I'm reading too much into it, but I don't think so. I think that whoever wrote this episode really had Nietzsche in mind, or at least had the philosophical underpinnings of Nietzsche in mind. So let's back up and talk about Nietzsche a little bit, because I think you have to kind of understand this to make sense of my point here. Nietzsche basically says, well, we're biological beings that were not very safe in the world. So we invented knowledge. We invented ways to keep ourselves safe and secure in the world. And what we do is we kind of take that fact about ourselves, put ourselves on a pedestal, and call that feature of ourselves, our consciousness and our knowledge, the defining characteristic of an intelligent being, the pinnacle of creation, right? But he says we forget that all of our ways of knowing are deeply metaphorical. It's one sphere being translated into another sphere, being translated into another sphere. All the while, we have these individual perspectives along the way that we kind of gloss over when we're talking about objectivity and talking about knowledge. I mean, even something as simple as like, okay, you get a sensory impulse, you know, light waves come at you and that hits the back of your retina, causing a nerve impulse. That's already a metaphor. It's something being translated into something else, right? Then that gets translated into your consciousness, the mental pictures that you have. Okay, great. Oh, there's another metaphor. And then we translate that into language so we can talk about it and communicate with each other. Well, that's another metaphor. And then, you know, all of the scientific activities and all the activities philosophers do, they're all metaphor after metaphor after metaphor. And what we've done culturally and philosophically is forget that all of those quote unquote objective ways of knowing are deeply metaphorical. They're metaphor after metaphor after metaphor as a result of language, as a result of our mental pictures, as a result of our unique perspectives. And we kind of gloss over the fact that those came from our unique perspectives and gloss over the fact that those are all metaphors. Mm-hmm. You know, the words are not the things themselves, and our mental pictures are not the things themselves, and our herd-like behavior glosses over our individual perspectives into the world. So the only way we understand anything is through metaphor. Now, like we talked about before, the strong philosophers, according to Nietzsche, the future philosophers, the Quins and the Qs of the Q continuum, are the ones who take that concept of metaphor and run with it. I've got my metaphors and my perspectives. And from an artistic standpoint, that's my poem and my picture that I paint. And for you, it's that book that I write from my point of view. It's mm-hmm. the way I write my own life in an artistic individual sense, right? In the Übermensch sense, which is vastly misinterpreted for Nietzsche. But from a scientific standpoint, all of the things that we call objectivity are already metaphors for Nietzsche. So mm-hmm. I find this a really fascinating and deep philosophical point that if you're going to understand the Q continuum, it has to be through metaphor. What an interesting Nietzschean way of understanding knowledge in general, much less objective knowledge from a God's eye point of view.
I love the visual that we get of the Q continuum. And I think it's very telling the way this is portrayed. I don't know how much of this was really written into the episode. This episode was written by Sean Piller, son of Michael Piller, teleplay by Michael Piller. I don't know how intentional he was. I don't know if someone, you know, director of photography or something like that came in and really kind of informed this visual aspect of the continuum, if it was really something that came out of Sean Piller's mind. But, you know, you see that, you know, it's kind of this Dust Bowl 1930s Depression era, but everybody's dressed like they're right out of the 1920s. You have a sign that says never closes. You have one guy reading a book that looks very old.
It never closes. It never ends.
It never ends.
Come, Sisyphus at the front door.
Yeah, yeah. It's just this is the way it is. Everybody's just standing around. Nobody's excited about it. Even the dog is laying there, just unamused. Doesn't even bark. You've got a guy sitting on the porch. He's reading an old dusty book that says The Old. And even the lady who's reading the magazine that says The New, if you look at the imagery on the magazine, there's nothing new about it. It's mm-hmm. It's a very old, dated kind of magazine. It looks like something right out of the 1920s. And then you have a guy dressed like he's out of the 20s or 30s. He's not playing a video game. He's playing a pinball machine. You know, the galaxy.
The guy who smiles, right?
The guy who smiles
very
awkwardly.
In a very Sisyphus-like way.
Yes, yes. He's resigned. He's just playing his game. So the galaxy is just a game that they all play, and they're playing bocce or croquet or something. I think it was croquet.
Croquet with the planets?
With the planets,
God
one of them
God
being
doesn't
ours
play dice with the universe, but Q yeah. plays croquet with the planets.
Yes. Yeah. So here's this idea that not only is existence boring, but essentially what I read into that is that existence is boring because, see, eternity is boring. And these eternal beings who seemingly have the greatest gift that the universe has to offer, they're incredibly bored and they're incredibly outdated and they're incredibly lost in their mundane, you know, they're just pushing the stone uphill.
Except for Q,
universe.
Because the contrast between Q and Quinn is interesting because they both have the same basic experience. They're immortal beings. They've done it all. Q's been the scarecrow just as much as Quinn has, right? So why is Q able to overcome it? And it certainly doesn't bother the rest of the members of the Q continuum, right? All the members of the Q continuum that we see in this metaphorical description, they're pretty content. Even if they have paste a smile on, like the guy playing pinball, right? They're fine with it. It doesn't bother. And I know a lot of people like this, and you know a lot of people like this. There are a lot of people that this doesn't bother them at all. Like, they get up, and they go to work, and they do their things, and they've got their relationships, and their projects, and their jobs, and their lives and their families and their everything, and there's no existential angst to them whatsoever. They are perfectly mm-hmm. content herd members, right? Them aside, then we've got the Quins and the Qs that are left in the universe, right? All of the herd-like Q members aside. Quinn says, this is tedious, this is angsty, this is meaningless, I've been there and done it all, there's no novelty, so count me out. Commit suicide in a very Q-like way. People do that here on Earth. I can't deal with the meaninglessness of it all. Put a gun to the head, right? People do this. And then there are the Qs of the world, literally in the Q continuum, but for us here in the world, they're the people that go, I don't care if there's no objective meaning. I'm going to be myself. I'm going to be different yeah. from the herd. I'm going to go, you know, and for Q, that manifests itself in really unhealthy ways. He basically nitpicks in the universe, right? Or toys with the universe and, you know, plays with it. It's the universe is his plaything. And I know people like that too. There are the people who are like, the world is my playground, right? I'm going to buy a sports car. I'm going to, you know, Mach 2 with my hair on fire all the time. Universe is my playground, right? Nope. You know, that's one way. Kierkegaard, the Christian existentialist philosopher, called that the aesthetic way of being, constant novelty, right? But Q at the very end of the episode is like, I'm not going to be like the rest of the Q continuum. I hope I make them mad. I'm going to be my own Q. And that is more than enough for Q, you know, twirling his mustache to overcome the existential dread that is plaguing Quinn.
Sure, sure. I think it was the great 20th century American philosopher James Dean who said, live fast, die young, have a great looking corpse.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, what's the difference between that reckless way of treating the world as your playground and the authentic way that Heidegger or Camus or Nietzsche describes, you know, being your own individual in an authentic sense? To me, that has very different connotations than I'm going Mach 2 with my hair on fire. I'm, you know, going warp 9.9 with my hair on fire if you're in Starfleet, right? If you're driving the Delta Flyer if you're Tom Paris, right? That there's more subtlety to it than that. That's a very kind of vulgar way of treating the world as your playground, right? A more sophisticated way is, yeah, I'm going to be Q as opposed to the herd-like members of the Q continuum. I'm going to twirl my mustache and I'm going to, you know, be my own unique self and Q continuum be damned.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do find the aesthetics of the continuum very interesting. the road that leads out of town and back into town, and just the overall aesthetic. And so for me, it causes me to ask the question, at least from the perspective of the writer, or maybe it's the director of photography, I'm not sure, but it causes me to ask the question, you know, is this a critique of religion? Is this a critique of Christianity, or basically religious philosophy in general?
Well, let's do a little comparative analysis, even inside the Star Trek universe. So let's count and consider the different ways that the Q continuum is depicted in Star Trek. And maybe we can broaden it just a little bit to include the realm of the prophets in the wormhole in Deep Space Nine. Maybe. In Voyager, we get this depiction of the Q continuum, the desert road depiction. We get the depiction of the Q continuum as a Civil War battlefield, essentially.
Yes.
It's interesting to compare and contrast those two, both of which deeply metaphorical depictions of the Q continuum. We also get the Next Generation depiction of the Q continuum, right? We get the kind of white, hazy afterlife depiction of the Q continuum that Q gives to Captain Picard.
Which is somewhat consistent with Deep Space Nine. It's an Apple commercial.
It's an Apple commercial. Yeah, okay. There will be iPhones in the afterlife. Good, I'm good. Okay, right. I was worried about that. Are there other depictions of the Q continuum that I'm forgetting about? Those seem to me, those are the three that I can remember off the top of my head.
I think that if a direct depiction of the Q continuum, that's it.
Well, let's think for a moment about how the realm of the prophets is depicted in Deep Space Nine. It's either hazy, like we've seen, or it's also metaphorical. It's done in terms of flashbacks, in terms of, you know, cast of characters that are, you know, that Sisko knows, but whom are serving as the voice of the prophets, and all of the imagery sure. are metaphorical.
Right.
And some, and in some depictions, it's very metaphorical, like when Sisko's mother is revealed to be a prophet, right? That depiction, you know, the sort of dream sequence that he has there is very metaphorical. The same kind of depiction that got the desert and you've got the robes and you got the whatnot, yes. right? Very similar, yes. similar imagery, in fact. I don't really know why. I'm not sure if it's used for the same purpose, but...
And again, I find it interesting that in all of these depictions... let's separate for a moment the white hazy Apple commercial kind of Q continuum slash wormhole with yep. the prophets. But all of the depictions that we see, even in these flashback sequences with the prophets in Deep Space Nine, you're going backwards. You're looking back. So it's almost as though there's an intent there to say that eternity is passé. It's old. It's ancient.
Can I get that on a bumper sticker? Eternity is passé.
Eternity is passé.
If there were ever a Nietzschean bumper sticker, that's it.
But seriously though, I think it's interesting that, you know, we have this kind of 1930s Dust Bowl continuum. We have, you know, the blue and the gray, the Civil War Q continuum. We have these flashback kind of sequences where, you know, everything with the wormhole aliens is something from Sisko's past. It's his, you know, his long deceased spouse. It's, you know, so on and so forth. His mother, it's whatever. It's always drawing from the past. And again, I wonder sometimes if there's an intent there to kind of paint eternity or paint heaven or to paint religion as something old, something past.
I don't know about that. I mean, it's easier. I mean, we understand metaphors from the past. We don't, I mean, just like, you know, someone from ancient Rome wouldn't necessarily understand an iPhone, right? I mean, there's a sense in which future imagery is already inherently incomprehensible. You know, it's the past metaphors are easier to understand and definitely easier to come up with probably. So
yeah,
I don't know. I do have a question about this might be changing the subject a little bit, but I do have a question about Star Trek as a whole. Again, maybe related to Nietzsche here. I maybe didn't plan to talk about Nietzsche quite as much as we are, but while we're talking about it, this question came to
mind. I think it's unavoidable.
This question came to my mind. If the afterlife is a type of escapism, if objectivity is a type of escapism, if an objective purpose in our life is a kind of escapism, if, any sort of philosophical notion of a soul or a disembodied consciousness or an eternal state of being up above and beyond our physical embodied selves that Nietzsche thinks are who we really are, all of that is a type of escapism. Do you think that all of Star Trek could be seen as escapist in this sense? I sometimes have this worry. here on Earth, we have problems. I've got problems in day-to-day life. You've got problems in day-to-day life. We've got problems in our local city. You've got problems in your local city. We've got problems in our country. Other people have problems in their countries, right? All of the sort of problems and challenges and meaningfulness and projects happen here. And so what do we do as Star Trek fans? We go, oh my God, I want to be out there traveling the stars, you know, on a starship, away from this earthly life, right? Does that have the same kind of escapism quality that Nietzsche is saying that the afterlife or an immortal soul or an immortal state of being has for us embodied folks? Is all of Star Trek escapist, in other words?
I think the short answer to that question is yes. I've followed often these conversations that happen on social media. Certainly they happen in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. We have these conversations about Star Trek and fandom and that being a type of escapism. So I think the short answer is yes, absolutely. That being said, I find it fascinating and I'm as guilty as anybody else. I've had a bad day, and I come home and I'll pop in an episode of Star Trek and I get lost among the stars.
And fiction is like, you're a fiction writer. I mean, yeah. you're part of the problem, Mike. No, I'm just joking.
I'm a dealer. I really am. I'm a dealer of escapism.
A fiction dealer.
But the reality is, first of all, I believe that the world is a better place when pages turn and people dream. I think that Star Trek has inspired so much progress over the course of the last, 52 years, that we can't even, I mean, we can point to small things here and there, but, you know, there are more individual stories than probably you and I could ever track down in a lifetime of people whose lives have been bettered or benefited, or they've somehow been inspired, by Star Trek. And even go broader than that, you think about speculative fiction in general and how that kind of fuels the fires of imagination. So the short answer, again, to your question is yes. The thing that I find fascinating about calling Star Trek a type of escapism, I've had a bad day. You know, I've dealt with some things during the course of my day that have gotten me down or they've stressed me out or whatever. And I come home and I pop in an episode of Star Trek and I dream of going among the stars. Zachary, think about this for a second. I mean, you know, in the course of my day-to-day life, I am not faced with the destruction of my ship and the death of 1,000 people at the hands of Romulans, you know? I find it interesting that we're escaping in this thing that only presents danger.
Well, I think there's a healthy type of escapism and there's an unhealthy type of escapism. I think if you're saying, oh my God, the world sucks, so let me imagine myself on a starship exploring the galaxy and, you know, pacify that existential worry of the world, you know, being so terrible, that's not very healthy. If you say, I really like the vision of the Star Trek universe, I like the way humans relate to each other, I like what we get from exploring the galaxy, I like what we see from the characters and, you know, human nature, so I'm going to work to make that happen. You know, I'm going to make my life better. I'm going to go get that college degree, or I'm going to go be an astronaut, or I'm going to whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, even if it's something like tangentially related, I'm going to do my little part for the greater good of future humans, right?
Yeah.
And we don't often think of what we're doing in those terms, I think. But I mentioned I reread Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. He basically said as much. He's like, you know, every day the birds and the bees and all the natural creatures out there get up every day and they do their part for the greater good of making their little tiny world an orderly place. And we humans can do that, you know, or we can choose to be lazy, stay in our beds, comfy and warm, safe and secure, not taking any risks, not building anything, not doing anything, not approaching life in this constructive sense. But we can do better about that as humans. We can really build the Star Trek future if we want it to be that way. But it takes individual people saying, yeah, I might not be able to be a Starfleet captain, but I can build that for future humans. You know, I can learn something new. I can get that degree. I can, you know, relate better with others. I can become or help lay the foundation for whatever the future is going to be. I can help build it. You know, again, it's not in this grand monument sense. Like, you're not building the Roman Colosseum. You're not building a starship, but you're contributing your little piece of the puzzle. And in a very kind of collective sense, like, I'm an individual human and I can do my little part in my little lifespan for, you know, for the legacy of future humans to bring something into fruition. Is that escapism? In a way, it's it's saying, yeah, the world today is not all that great. It should be better. It should be different. So let's imagine a better way of doing it. I think where it goes into escapism, if that doesn't motivate you to do something different with your life, then it's escapism. If that is a motivating factor, if it's like, okay, so because this is how I want the universe to be, here are the choices I'm going to make in my own life or in my little domain, my little sphere, my little lifetime, my town, my education, my country, my world, my projects, my whatever. That doesn't motivate you to do anything. I would say it's mere escapism. You know, it doesn't have to be escapism in this negative sense. It could be just recognizing that the world isn't as good as it should be. And it's all up to us to do our orderly part, just like the birds and the bees do, according to Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think you have two types of escapism. You have a Reginald Barclay kind of escapism, where you're running away from something. And
I've lost
and
myself in Voyager.
You've lost yourself in Voyager.
Yeah, as Barclay exactly. says. Barclay says that literally. It's a quote from Barclay.
Yes, and then I think you have a Nog type of escapism. It was an escape for him at a difficult period of his life, and in that escape, he discovered that he wasn't as broken perhaps as he thought he was, and that he could still have a good life. He could still live a good life. And that was a very healthy type of escapism for him. Of course, referencing It's Only a Paper Moon.
So I kind of wish we had more depictions of the Hugh Continuum. These are so interesting. And like I said, they're very Nietzschean. They're creative and artistic. From a filming standpoint, you have to make these interesting choices about how you visually depict these aspects of the Hugh Continuum. I kind of wish we had more of that. Maybe we need a new Star Trek series just on the Hugh Continuum, which is metaphor after metaphor after metaphor. Jumping.
Maybe we'll get that in the Picard series. But maybe. You know, I have to say, I'm really glad that they just didn't pull the trigger and do a bunch of CGI stuff. Of course, you know, the technology was different then. I love the fact, I know I sound critical about these depictions of eternity, these metaphors in Star Trek.
There's no harps in them.
No harps in them. But I sound critical, but the reality is I find these interesting. I look at the little things like the road and the dog and the, you know, I look at the scarecrow and I look at these little things and it makes me think, and I love that. Well, I love that about how they portray the Q continuum.
If you take any one of our lives, mine or yours or anyone else's, and take the kind of visual imagery associated with our day-to-day lives, if one of those had been the metaphor of the Q continuum, would that be any different? This is Camus talking now. Doesn't it all just look like Sisyphus? You could take, you know, just looking around where I'm sitting now, I've got radio stuff, I've got Star Trek stuff, we've got family stuff, you know, kind of, okay, suppose that were the depiction of the Q continuum. Is that any different or better than a desert road from the perspective of Camus and the myth of Sisyphus? I don't know. You know, I think so. I mean, I get invested in things. We all do, right? But,
yeah,
you know, if you step back and take the QI perspective or the God's eye perspective on it, you might say, well, looks just as arbitrary and just as tedious as the desert road, you know, from the perspective of objectivity, not from the perspective of being invested in it, from the objective perspective.
Well, Zachary, I love the fact that your eternity and my eternity are equally eclectic and random. I love that.
So I have a couple of other questions that came up, and I don't think we have time to dive into these, but they're topics for future Metatrex episodes. One we already mentioned, what if God chose not to exist? You know, or can a Q choose not to exist as a necessarily existing being? I kind of thought of that as paradoxical, and you kind of solved that for me. You said, well, in order to commit suicide, Quinn has to become mortal first, and then he can commit suicide. Oh, I never really, such an obvious point. I never really looked at that. I just kind of assumed that an omnipotent, omniscient, immortal being like a Q could go, boom, boom, will himself out of existence. But no, he's got to become a mortal being first. That's an interesting resolution to that paradox.
And I should say I also find a fascinating parallel here, and it's loose, but I think I can make it without overly trying to shoehorn it in. I think it's fascinating that at the end of the episode, Quinn suggests perhaps that he's dying for his people, that this is a gift that he's giving to his people. So God has become man and died for his people. I find something very Christ-like in that. So I see a type of Christ in some ways.
Well, people made that connection with Socrates as well. I mean, that's,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
In terms of archetypes, maybe. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought that was fascinating. Anyway.
I really kind of wanted to explore the connection between this episode and Death of a Salesman a little more. You know, we're ostensibly talking about philosophy, but I think this is a fascinating connection on the sort of qualitative experiential nature of our, you know, professional, corporate, you know, play it safe kind of existences that we all have. And I love that Death of a Salesman just ends with the death of the main character. So, you know, we have Death of a Salesman, but we might as well have called this episode Death of a Q. It's basically Death of a Salesman in space. I love that Q calls the other members of the Q continuum that we see in this depiction of the Q continuum happy people. It says, these are happy people. Look, and then the one guy smiles from his pinball machine.
Yes.
The most awkward smile ever in the history of smiles. But so is Sisyphus, smiling, pushing his rock up the mountain. And I just wrote down a question. Happy people. Isn't that the goal of all of us? Don't we want to be happy people? And every time I think, you know, whether it's in psychology, whether it's culturally, whether it's in terms of, you know, the goal in life, every time I hear someone say the goal of life is happiness, I kind of cringe a little bit. Like, do we really just want to be happy, pacified people like the members of the Q continuum inside this episode? I'm happy playing my game, or I'm happy doing my ham radio stuff, or I'm happy doing my podcast. Is that really it? Is happiness, doesn't this episode just show that there's a way of being happy that is still dissatisfying? Another line that stood out to me really quickly is that Q says, I believed in the ultimate purity of the Q. It's like, it feels like the writers were trying to make this kind of Nazi connection that people often make to Nietzsche, but kind of failed at getting that point across. It's something that felt really tacked on to me, and I'm not sure why Q had that line.
I didn't see that necessarily the same way that you saw it. Certainly, I know that, you know, there's kind of those Nazi connections that oftentimes historians try to make to Nietzsche.
Oh, which is a bad connection because it's a huge misunderstanding of Nietzsche. Yeah.
Without a doubt. Nietzsche famously argued against anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So, it's a terrible connection to make.
And the last thing I noticed, of course, I mentioned this already, but the hemlock reference, the Nogach hemlock reference at the end, is an unsubtle reference to Socrates. And I can't help but say, it's not just about euthanasia. You know, at the end of the episode, we're basically saying the Socrates-like characters are the ones who have a death wish. You know, this wraps the Nietzsche angle up full, you know, for me, hook, line, and sinker, full barrel for me. This is an explicit reference to Nietzsche's point that Socrates had a death wish.
Yes.
Is he a salvation figure? Is he more like a Christ figure? Is he more like a tragic Socrates figure?
I think we can actually see both.
I think we should leave our listeners, as we wrap up the episode, with Q's words at the end of the episode. Because we all have people in our life telling us this. If you go against the grain, you're going to rub people the wrong way. You're going to ruffle people's feathers. Play it safe, go with the flow. If you go against the grain, if you're too much of an individual, you're going to make people mad. And I love Q's response, I hope so. You know who else I could imagine saying that, actually? There's one other character in all of Star Trek I could imagine saying, maybe two. I could imagine Captain Kirk saying that, but I had more in mind here. I could imagine Worf saying that. I hope so.
Very, 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 I hope so.
Yes, I kind of hear Worf's voice there.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Death Wish today, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
But good discussion. Like, I love, you know, talking about the science. And Joe, I love that you bring it up. Justin.
I need to stop reading it. I'm sorry.
I'm closing, doing
Close
my
the
final thoughts.
Close
and
the
you're
window,
all
Justin.
Laughing over me.
Joe, you need to keep all of this,
this
in.
Is a, this is an intervention, Justin.
Okay.
Close the window.
Oh my gosh.
Literary Treks.
I talked to Bob Klein, who I had interviewed for Saturday Morning Trek. And he's like, yeah, come on over. Let's go look through my garage and see what we find. I'm like, okay. So I drive over there and I was greeted to two, you know, those fold out tables that you have for like picnics? Two of those end to end with like three boxes, larger than files boxes and like moving boxes size, and just papers and folders that all had Filmation on it just brought out.
Standard Orbit.
I bought it. When it first came out, I played it for like 2 or 3 days, and I went, "What is going on? Am I missing something? Is just I'm not a good player." So, and then I checked on the reviews online, and everyone agreed that it was not a good game, and we were all correct.
And introducing our newest show, The Line, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
I'm so honored that I was chosen to pick Picard, and as a Next Generation fan, I mean, he was one of my favorite characters. And so I wanted to, and I know how he is extra special to lots of Star Trek fans beyond even just being the character he played on the series. And so I really felt a huge responsibility to try to give the fans something that was enjoyable, but and honored who he was, even though it was staying true to the fact that he is 20 years older.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways that you can mind meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference we mentioned in the podcast. That is our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, when you're not doing the Scarecrow, where can people find you around the interwebs and on Trek FM?
I'm doing the Scarecrow. It sounds like some sort of a dance. I mean, when you're not doing the Scarecrow, where can we find you? Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to Star Trek Voyager. Speaking of Star Trek Voyager, you can also follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Frueling. And Mike, when you're not busy smiling through the pinball game of life, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around Trek.fm.
I sure play a mean pinball. Well, Zachary, you can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. You can also check out Twitter. It's at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. My website, cmichaelmorrison.com or hannahgoodhart.com. Well, if you'd like to keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and latinum to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We'd really appreciate any support you can give us, and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, our art director, Aaron Harvey, production manager, Richard Marquez, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. I'd also like to give a special shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with him on Twitter at MagicDrop5, Kay Shaw, she's at Choco Weeble, our friend Norman Lau at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker at Mark74656.
Speaking of Voyager.
And Zachary, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.